From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Delegates from around the world have gathered today in Montreal to talk about the next step in combating global warming. Here in the lower 48, sky-high energy costs are leading some states to take a second look at the sun for solutions. California has cut a deal with Sterling Energy Systems, a Phoenix startup, to build two massive solar farms that would be the largest solar project in history. If it works, by 2010, they would provide electricity to hundreds of thousands of Los Angeles and San Diego homes and would more than double the state's solar capacity. California isn't the only state looking for a sunshine deal. 20 other states, including Colorado, New Jersey, and New Mexico, have established renewable energy targets. This hour, On Point, with energy prices through the roof, solar energy rises again. The new economics and technology that may make solar power a real player after all. We'll be talking with the CEO of Sterling Energy Systems and with Daniel Kamen and Frank Laird, two of the country's top solar energy experts. But first, we begin in Montreal with a closer look at today's big follow-up conference on the Kyoto Protocols and global warming. Peter Spotts is science correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us now from Montreal. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So you've got a huge gathering there, 10,000 delegates from 180 countries. What's the goal?
The goal is to figure out what to do when the Kyoto Protocol's first, they call it its first commitment period, ends in 2012. This is the period, it runs from 2008 to 2012, during which the industrial countries who are party to the treaty have to reduce their emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, by about 5.5% on average.
So they're looking beyond 2012 to see what comes next. Just to remind ourselves, Kyoto was ratified in 1997, but then took 7 years to be implemented, in part because of resistance and a no thanks from the United States. It just went into effect in February of this year for the 08 kickoff.
Exactly. We have the treaty was negotiated in 1997 in Kyoto. It finally entered into force earlier this year in February because enough industrial nations had signed on to meet the requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the first meeting of the members of the Kyoto Protocols, as well as the larger Framework Convention on Climate Change, of which the Kyoto Protocol is a part, to sort of celebrate their success, but also to begin the hard slogging process of figuring out what comes next.
Success, and yet, at this point, I guess nearly everyone is saying climate change is a fact. It's happening.
That's correct. Researchers around the world are pointing to a number of different signs, from the Arctic to water vapor over the Alps, and even some are beginning to point to tropical cyclones or hurricanes and typhoons worldwide, and think they're beginning to see signals of global warming in trends in these storms. So the evidence appears to be mounting.
The United States, along, of course, famously with China and India, is not part of the Kyoto Protocol. You and others quote Princeton University's Michael Oppenheimer saying the world is in the middle of the critical decade in terms of curbing greenhouse gas emissions before they begin to do real serious harm with irreversible consequences. What kind of future options are being discussed in Montreal? Is there something out there that might look different than Kyoto that might draw in the United States?
Well, that's what everybody hopes. The president has made it clear that if the whatever comes next involves mandatory emissions targets and fixed timetables, he's not interested. So people are trying to finesse that by coming up with other possible approaches that already sound surprisingly like what the administration is already doing. But beyond trying to draw the administration in, as you pointed mm-hmm. out, they're also very interested in getting China and India on board. And interestingly, Tony Blair, who is the head of the EU this year, as well as the G8, has been arguing that these more flexible measures actually should apply to China and India, but that the industrial countries need to continue using these mandatory targets and timetables, and probably after 2012, the targets are likely to become much tighter. So it's kind of a two-tiered approach on his part, where the industrial countries continue with mandatory measures, but trying to provide more flexible measures for developing countries to at least bring them into the process.
Peter, is Washington officially represented in Montreal? Is the Bush administration participating in this conversation?
Oh, absolutely. The Bush administration is not a party to the Kyoto Protocol, as you pointed out. However, the United States did ratify the 1992 Framework Convention on Climate Change and is a party to that. So there will be a U.S. delegation here, and it will be dealing with issues of interest to it under this broader Framework Convention on Climate Change,
and
which the Kyoto Protocols are a part.
You made a reference to what the shape of a new agreement might be. If it's not mandatory targets, timetables, and reductions, what might it look like, and why would a non-mandatory program work?
Well, that's the big question, because the whole reason for the Kyoto Protocol in the first place was that the developed nations the Framework Convention originally involved voluntary approaches, and it wasn't working. Nevertheless, one of the things it might look might embrace would, instead of having targets on absolute emissions, you might set a target for something called carbon intensity, which is essentially a measure of how much carbon dioxide your economy puts out for a given unit of economic growth. So that's one possibility. Others include, particularly for developing countries, instead of establishing targets and timetables across an entire economy, maybe you only pick out one or two sectors of the economy, like power generation, that are particularly egregious emitters, and try and just focus on those to get started.
Peter, you follow this world a lot. Is there hope out there that the world community will turn the corner on carbon emissions, get a handle on climate change, on global warming?
Yeah, I think there's always hope, Tom, but in fact, even here in the United States, you see many people perceive a lack of action on the part of Washington, there's a lot going on at the state and local level. In fact, I saw one number recently that suggested that 25% of the country, through various state and local activities, will actually meet Kyoto-like targets within the time frame that Kyoto sets. So there's a lot of interesting action going on at the state and local level that may be building up momentum from the ground up, such that when there is a new administration, I think there's a fairly sizable expectation and perhaps hope among some people that a new administration might be a lot more favorable to reconnecting with the Kyoto process and reengaging the international community in this.
A critical decade. We're going to be looking at one thread in that conversation in this hour. Peter Spotts in Montreal, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Peter Spotts, science correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We turn now to our main topic this hour, the new face of solar energy. Tim Natick is a contributor to Technology Review magazine. He's written about the California Sterling Energy Deal and joins me now from San Francisco. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's nice to be with you, Tom.
We know it's a big world out there with lots of different alternative energy possibilities. We hear a lot about wind power. The president talks about fuel cells. Of course, nuclear is getting another look these days, if we can call that alternative fuel. But what is the nature of the deal that California is looking at with solar energy, this new technology in solar energy?
Well, that's right. And there are a couple of energy companies that are investing in what is sort of a old but new technology, which is through Sterling Energy. And that's basically a combination of two different approaches. One is being concentrating solar energy, and that's done through a series of dishes. These are large, about 40-foot tall dishes made of many different mirrors, concentrating the heat of the sun to a central point, and using that concentrated heat from, in this case, Southern California Edison, using 20,000 of these spread out through the California desert, raising enough heat to drive a piston and create energy to a point that is more efficient than has ever been done before through solar energy. So it's looking very positive for proponents of solar.
We're talking industrial-scale production, utility company-scale production here, not the flat panels on the roof that might give a little trickle of power to the house or heat up the shower. I mean, looking at images of this, it looks like something out of a Star Wars movie. These are giant mirrored solar dishes, as you say, with the piston filled with a cylinder of hydrogen gas out front. This is very, very large-scale energy production.
That's right. This is very large scale. They're hoping to Southern California Edison with their deal. There's also a San Diego Gas and Electric is another that has signed a recent deal. But they're building 500 megawatt and 300 megawatt plants, which is about comparable to a coal plant. So this is far from the photovoltaic cells you might use to heat your pool.
Now, if this all goes through, how many homes might be powered by solar in California?
They're hoping that this will reach almost 300,000 homes. So quite a number. Again, relative to a coal plant.
Right, as if solar stepping up and being the equivalent of an old-fashioned power plant, and here with many, many acres or square miles of these giant dishes. Do you see in this the possibility of a new day for solar? It had a kind of a fuddy-duddy image for a long time. Tim, is it poised for a comeback here?
Yeah, well, you know, it really does look, I mean, people are very optimistic about it right now, and there's certainly a lot of potential. Solar, from scientists that I've talked to, is tremendously powerful. I mean, they say that you can get more energy from the sun in an hour than what the planet consumes in an entire year. The problem has just been trying to harness that, and having a new system that is more efficient seems to have a more positive outlook for that.
Well, we can see that. We see it in the images. Listeners, you can see a link to these images at our website, onpointradio.org. Tim Natick, contributor to Technology Review magazine, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're talking about solar energy again this hour, a big new push in California, maybe around the world. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about solar energy again and how new economics and technology could soon make solar power a real player after all. You can join the conversation. What do you think? With oil and natural gas prices over the moon, are you ready to take a fresh look at the sun? Did you think solar was going to take off 30 years ago? Could it be that sunshine's time has finally come in the energy arena? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The thing that has people talking is a big new deal between some California entities and Sterling Energy of Phoenix. They've got great big dishes. The plan is to have huge farms of them in the deserts of the Southwest, producing real industrial strength levels of energy. We're joined right now from Phoenix, Arizona, by the Chief Executive Officer of Sterling Energy Systems, Bruce Osborne. Bruce Osborne, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be with you.
What can you tell us about the deals you've cut in California? What's in train here?
Well, we've got two deals. The first one is with Southern California Edison. We signed that in August of this summer, and it's for the world's largest solar project. And it starts off with 500 megawatts and has the potential to grow to 850 megawatts. And to put that in perspective, Tom, that's about 300,000 homes in the L.A. area for 500 and about 500,000 if we go to the 850 megawatts.
Now, we're talking here about something like 20,000 of these very large solar dishes. They look like big communication satellite dishes, but mirrored.
Exactly. They're about 37 feet in diameter. And they're two-axis tracking, so they follow the sun during the day from morning till evening. And for the 500 megawatts, it would be 20,000 of these. And if we go to 850, that would be 34,000. So, and they're kind of like funny-shaped automobiles. You've got back silvered glass, which are the mirrors that
yep.
Basically is a big reflective magnifying glass that concentrates the energy to kind of a high, fierce temperature. And we use that high heat to run a Stirling engine that turns a crankshaft to turn a generator.
Now, Stirling engine itself is actually an old technology. It goes back to 1816 and Robert Stirling, the Scotsman.
Exactly. And he was a Scottish minister that first came up with the design. And what's unique about it is it's an external heat engine as opposed to an internal combustion engine. And it requires no combustion, no fuels. And we use the free fuel of the sun. Take that heat, as I mentioned before, to concentrate it and run the Stirling engine. So no fuel, no price volatility with that, and no emissions. It's environmentally friendly.
You know, in a time when people talk about having to go to war for oil and spending billions in the Middle East and worrying about energy security, it sounds very appealing. How scalable is this, Bruce Osborne? How far could it go?
Tom, it is very scalable, and one of the unique things about it is when we have these dishes, they're modular. You can go from one dish at 25 kilowatts that'll run, you know, maybe 10 homes or something, to large-scale utility size, you know, the 500 megawatts or beyond, which runs many hundreds of thousands of homes. So it's very scalable. We've got some statistics that if you take a 10 square miles, which seems like a lot of land. It would be 10 sections out in, say, the Mojave Desert or the Imperial Valley where we're putting our two facilities. That will produce enough energy to be equivalent to Hoover Dam, which takes 247 square miles with Lake Mead. So it's enormous. If you're to take 100 miles square, which is quite a bit of land again, but just to give you a feel, that's a small percentage of the total desert in California, you could actually replace all the fossil fuel consumption in the United States.
100 miles and square in a desert in California, all the fossil fuels could be... I mean, that's astounding. Is that going to be practical?
Well, I don't think Sterling Energy or any of the solar folks are looking to replace or displace conventional electrical generation. But I think it is a part of the solution, and I think if you look at all the sources that we have, it provides a great solution, especially as we look at increasing and growing our energy consumption here in the U.S. and elsewhere in the globe. And so as you add new capacity, new energy, why not make it renewable, and in particular solar? Solar has the added benefit, Tom, of it produces peak power during the peak demand part of the day.
Yep.
And that's why our customers are gravitating towards solar. You know, during the middle part of the day, the hot part of the day, people want to run their office lights, their computers, and especially air conditioners, and we produce peak power then. You know, other renewables such as wind, et cetera, are great. They're becoming inexpensive and less, cost less than some of the conventional forms of electricity generation, but they're producing it at night, and we have plenty of capacity then when we need it most is during the peak part of the day.
There's something really heartening about this kind of conversation. We'll do some reality checking in here just a moment about what some of the obstacles may be. I wish you'd describe the technology a bit more. People are so accustomed to those flat panels on top of the house that just don't look like much. These huge dishes, you're saying that the sort of a parabola or bowl shape of the dish concentrates the heat that's collected from the sun on this cylinder that's filled with, is it hydrogen? Is that right, Bruce?
Yes, the working fluid or the working gas inside can be air, helium, or hydrogen, and it turns out hydrogen's the most efficient from a heat transfer and thermodynamic standpoint.
And then it feeds it right into the electricity grid, so this can play right alongside gas-fired plants or coal or nuclear or anything else.
That's true. Right now we're looking at large-scale standalone solar because, again, as I mentioned before, in California and the solar Southwest, we need peak power.
Now, this is a technology that's been around for a while. You bought it off, was it McDonnell Douglas, I think?
Yeah, actually, the genesis of it goes back to the late 70s. I was actually with Ford Motor Company, their aerospace, and we came up with the original concept to put the parabolic mirror together with the Stirling engine to generate electricity.
So why hasn't it happened? Why hasn't it happened in all those years?
Great question. It's primarily economics. And, when back in those days we had OPEC oil embargoes, we had Three Mile Island nuclear leak, et cetera, and I thought it would be prime time. We had President Carter that was talking about energy independence, et cetera. But it gets right back to economics, Tom. And what's different today than it was 20, 25, 30 years ago is we've been quietly improving and perfecting the technology so that we have the performance and the reliability. And the second part is working hard to get the cost down, and I think our commercialization efforts are allowing us to do that.
Bruce Osborne, CEO of...
The engine is the most efficient of all the solar technologies, so it's about twice as efficient as the nearest competitor.
Mm-hmm.
That means you need about half the steel and glass and materials. The second part of it is a funny-shaped automobile, and it's amenable to high-volume manufacturing. So the high efficiency and the high volume manufacturing to get the cost down, that combination allows us to offer very attractive pricing.
Bruce Osborne in Phoenix, please stand by. They're at the head of Sterling Energy. I want to get some perspective on all this. Joining us from Denver, Colorado is Frank Laird. He is professor at the Graduate School of International Studies, University of Denver, studies science, technology, public policy, author of Solar Energy, Technology, Policy, and Institutional Values. Frank Laird, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us from Oakland, California, is Daniel Kamen. He's director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory at the University of California at Berkeley, where he's a professor of public policy, co-author of Should We Risk It? Exploring Environmental Health and Technological Problem Solving. Daniel Kamen, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're there in California. This can sound very exciting from a great distance. Is it exciting? Do we see a new day dawning for solar energy here?
Well, we do, and there's a whole number of things that have come together. Obviously, you just heard about the high oil prices and also the volatility of fossil fuel prices. One of the big things is that California's worked very hard to get coal out of our energy mix, at least coal we burn in state. And what that's done is it's made our energy mix is much cleaner, but also that we're much more exposed to the price volatilities, whether it comes from foreign engagements or whether it's price gouging from other companies out of state.
And of course, you've had rolling blackouts and the whole works there, every kind of energy woe.
There's woes, but also this has really been the source of innovation. So the big deal you were just talking about with the Stirling engines is one key piece of it. And that was driven by a very important piece of policy that California is one of 20 states to have called the Renewable Portfolio Standard. But there's much more going on in that as well. California has an executive order written by the governor that will put us on a path to more than meet the Kyoto Protocol. There's something that
this is Arnold Schwarzenegger aiming for a 33% of California's energy coming from renewable energy sources by 2020, if I've got that right.
Well, that's one of the two proposals. The RPS, as it's called right now, says that California should get 20% of its electricity from renewables by 2017, and it's the good economics of the solar system plus the push of that bill that really put through the deal with Southern California Edison for the Stirling systems. But that's only a part of what's going to go on. Mm-hmm. There's some concerns about how it will all come together, but right now the state is debating what you just mentioned, going to 33% of energy from renewables by 2020, so increasing the amount, or going to 20% by 2010. Mm-hmm. So it's an acceleration in time or in amount, and some of us are hoping we can get actually both of those through.
Frank Laird in Denver, give us some perspective here. I mean, we've seen so much trouble around energy. Consumers facing these enormous home heating prices right now for this winter, kind of budget crushing. We're at war in Iraq. The idea when Bruce Osborne, and he's still with us, when he says, 100 square miles of these dishes and you could replace all the fossil fuels in America in a corner of California's deserts, it seems like, well, okay, let's go, let's do it. Then it must be more complicated than that. Why? What?
It is more complicated than that. In a way, this is the third time we've faced this kind of problem since the Second World War, because there was an oil shortage right after the Second World War. And, of course, everyone remembers the oil shortage in the 1970s.
Right.
And now here we go again. And part of the reason it's so complicated is the energy system is just so huge and complex. It's not like you just take one machine, unplug it from the wall, and plug a different one in. You have to replace an enormous amount of technology. You have to train people to run and operate the technology. You have to have bankers that know how to loan money to companies that are doing the technology. What's so encouraging to me now is that for the first time, we're seeing a very different group of corporate players get into this. These are not just small firms out there. The sorts of firms interested in renewable energy of all types include folks like British Petroleum, Royal Dutch Shell, Kyocera of Japan, and so on. So we're seeing some serious commitment by very large firms to get involved in this. Plus, the technology is better. I mean, things weren't that ready to go in the 1970s, and they're much more ready to go now.
Do you have a sense of what portion of the nation's energy needs could one day be supplied by solar? I mean, it suddenly sounds, when you talk about this industrial strength production, it sounds feasible to talk in big numbers. How big could they be?
Boy, that's the $64,000 question, and I hem and haw because every time you say something like that, 5 years later, you look back and you're really embarrassed by yourself. But certainly the kinds of numbers you're hearing now, the 10%, 20%, and beyond 20%, are clearly feasible. And in fact, Denmark gets upwards of 20% of its electricity already from wind. I mean, so the idea that various kinds of renewable energy could be big players is no longer fanciful.
I want to bring our callers into this conversation, if I may, Frank.
We should just clarify one thing if you have a chance.
Yes, please, Daniel.
Just because the different solars alone really span the spectrum. And the solar thermal is right now the least expensive and the one that's the most ready to go for these large-scale commercial applications.
Solar thermal, that means what we're talking about this morning? That's using
right.
the heat
the
of the dishes.
The Stirling engine is sort of a way to think about mm-hmm. a solar version of a big power plant.
Yes.
But you really shouldn't sort of downplay what the photovoltaics can do mm-hmm. because that's the solar panels on people's rooftops.
Right.
You were saying before, it looks sort of small and insignificant. But in fact, in places like Germany and Japan and California, rooftop solar, such as my home and more than 70,000 other homes in California have, mm-hmm. that was actually a feature that had a big impact on reducing the number of blackouts we had in 2001. And in many ways, it's integrating solar into buildings, which has a lot of people very excited, not about what's going to happen in the next year or two,
right.
but over the many coming years, the idea that buildings themselves could become power plants. You could have a Stirling dish on the roof, but you also might have roofing materials themselves that are photovoltaic that generate their own power. And what's the most exciting feature is not that there's one winning technology, but that if you look at the innovation rates and mm-hmm. the efficiency gains across all of these, that's where the potential to get solar out of this niche market and to become a really big player comes in.
So don't poo-poo the old photovoltaic panels on the rooftop. They might play an important piece here, but gosh, it's exciting to see those dishes and think of feeding right into the grid as well. I want to begin to turn to our callers. A lot of them have been waiting. Ian is calling from Tacoma Park, Maryland. Hi, Ian. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Very interesting discussion. Thank you for hosting such a good forum.
I'm happy to do it.
About the peak versus trough production, if they've figured that out, versus the longest day of the year on a very hot summer day versus the shortest day of the year like we're approaching soon,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of percentage variation there would be. And also, I've read something about this recently, and I'm wondering, is there a full-size standing model of one of these things in production anywhere?
Let's ask Bruce Osborne. He's the CEO. Ian, thanks for your call. Bruce, first, peak versus trough. It's great on a hot, long, sunny day. We can see that. What about a short, cloudy day? What kind of trough can you fall to here? What's the swing?
Yeah, there's about a 2-to-1 swing, to use that terminology, Tom. But it turns out when you have peak demand is usually during the long, hot summers in the Southwest. So we're actually producing the peak power when it's most required. So during the winter time, when there isn't as large a demand, our production is reduced, but it's commensurate with demand.
But do you need backup power somehow? Is solar consistent and reliable enough with that swing that you could rely on it at a large scale, you know, without, an old coal plant waiting to kick in on a bad stretch of cloudy days?
Yeah, well, it turns out that on the bad cloudy days, you don't have the peak demand, so the old coal plants or gas-fired plants do just fine. What we're really looking at is peaking power right now. As we go forward, we'll be adding storage, and there are a number of ways to do that. We can take the electricity and put it into conventional battery-type storage. We can put it into flywheels. We can pump hydro. Or the future is actually converting the electricity into hydrogen using electrolyzers. So a lot of opportunities there.
And what about existing dishes right now? Where can Ian and others see something?
There are a couple of places. The best place right now is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at Sandia National Laboratories. They have the National Thermal Solar Test Facility there, and we have 10 units running. We have six that are basically put together as a model power plant. It's a slice out of this large-scale plant that we've been talking about. We're actually working on reliability improvements, looking at system dynamics, et cetera. We also have three smaller units. Instead of 25 kilowatts, they're 10 kilowatts. And we're looking at those for the future for remote, distributed applications, rural electrification. There's a lot of less industrialized parts of the world that are just clamoring for this technology as well. So we've got a couple of solutions in work.
Listeners, I really do encourage you to take a look. It looks quite amazing, these sort of Star Wars arrays of dishes imagined over big parts of the desert, and it could be reality soon. There's a link to Sterling's images at our website, onpointradio.org. Bruce Osborne, CEO of Sterling Energy Systems, we wish you good luck. We want to check in with you again when the thing really starts cranking. Go get them.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity to communicate and educate our exciting technology.
It's a lot of fun. We hope it works. Daniel Kamen and Frank Laird, we have to take a short break, but we'll be right back. Listeners, what do you think? Can you picture the deserts of the Southwest covered with giant solar collectors? Would it beat war in Iraq? Would you rather be plugged into Mideast oil or the Mojave to solar power? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about solar energy again and how new economics and technology could soon make solar power a real player. After all, you can join us. What do you think? Where would you rank the promise of solar next to wind farms, fuel cells, nuclear power, you name it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And it is a different picture. Very large fields of very large mirrored dishes that focus the thermal energy, the heat from the sun on a piston, a tank of hydrogen gas that turns pistons and can feed right into the regular energy grid. California is moving ahead with plans to do this on a large scale. We're joined from Oakland, California, in this hour by Daniel Kamen. He's director of Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley. And Frank Laird joins us from Denver, Colorado. He's professor at the Graduate School of International Studies at the University of Denver, author of Solar Energy. Right now, Tanya's calling us from Alston, Massachusetts. Hi, Tanya. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just have a question. I grew up in Phoenix, and I know that I think this is a really exciting development in the technology. I also know that living here in the East and talking to people who haven't really experienced deserts, they think of them as these kind of just dead wastelands.
Right.
But growing up in Phoenix, I know about the beauty and the vibrancy of the desert as well.
And the life that's there.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so I haven't seen the website yet to see what it looks like, but I hear you talking about this huge thing. And while the technology is exciting, I'm wondering what the impact, particularly the environmental impact on the desert will be, if there have been studies into that aspect of it.
It's a great question. I mean, it seems whichever way you turn on energy, there's some kind of impact. But let me ask our guests. Frank Laird, first to you, what about the environmental impact? I'm looking here at Sterling's image, and this is a vast field of these large dishes pulling down the sunlight, collecting the heat. What's the environmental impact?
There will certainly be one, and it's going to be important to do an important an environmental impact study of any of these plants. The main point I want to drive home, though, is there's an environmental impact no matter what you do. If you build a large coal plant, you've got the area of the coal plant plus the area where you're mining for coal. If you build a natural gas plant, you've got the natural gas fields where you're getting the natural gas in those plants. And those fields.
Right.
It's true the desert isn't dead, and it's true there's going to be some cost. So we'll have to build these with a lot of environmental sensitivity, have to do good environmental studies beforehand. But it's, as I think Bruce mentioned, putting in large solar plants could take up a lot less space than a large hydroelectric dam.
And it produces a lot of electricity, you know, given the backup of the water in the capture area. Daniel Kamen, it's in your backyard in the Mojave in California. What about it? I mean, we're talking 4 or 5, or is it 7 square miles here, hypothetically, in this deal of these dishes, maybe more if this works out. What's the impact environmentally?
Well, I mean, as you just heard, there would be an impact, but I think we have to really put this in perspective. It's not that we would go out and decide on, let's take an area of pristine desert and lay these out in large arrays and then make all of the area underneath it sort of dead space.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, most of these will likely go into places where there's already roads and access, and actually ranching areas is a more likely and a more natural fit because you already have road networks and all.
Right.
And the footprint of the individual towers is very small. instead of the Star Wars image you gave before, I
yes.
think a more accurate one might be like the microwave dishes you see for your cell phones, which are, you know, clustered or laid out on the landscape. And for those people who have seen movies like Contact with Jodie Foster,
right.
those radio dishes that they used to talk, you know, they used to listen to space, that's actually sort of the picture we're talking about. So it's dishes where you might have a big area where you have them laid out, but their footprint on the ground is actually quite small.
There's just so many of them. You're talking about 20,000 in a single array here.
Right, but if you think about it, we, for example, have areas in the U.S. West, in Texas, and in Canada, where the natural gas recovery and pipelines takes the entire area and lays down a grid of pipes of which you can't even get through. So it's the area is effectively dead.
Yeah,
this is not that sort of deal. We have all manner of animals living in areas where you have microwave dishes where you could put these up. And so, again, this is a technology that could have very, very small impact relative to other energy systems.
Yeah,
and a feature that we often talk about, so dual use. You can use lands for a variety of areas, for nature, for ranching, for farms. In fact, in Germany right now, they call the wind industry wind farming because the most natural pairing of wind turbines, and wind in northern Germany actually already provides fully a quarter of electricity, not a few percent.
Yeah, wow.
But a quarter.
And Lord knows it's not as if we're comparing this to some pristine energy source. The others, well, we've been talking about Montreal and global warming and all that impact. Dick is calling from Potomac, Maryland. Hi, Dick. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to give you some background on this that makes it easier for people to understand. If you go back in time, like to your grandfather's day, one of the things you had in your house was a gas refrigerator. And those gas refrigerators are basically the same thing that you're talking about here, except they're talking about with just hydrogen. The cycle they run on is called the Stirling cycle.
Exactly.
And that's what they're running with.
So it's been around. Do you think it's promising, Dick? Do you see the future here?
Because it brings two things together. It brings together the Stirling cycle using the Electrolux stuff mixed with the large solar things. I think the large solar things probably are best looked at from the experience that I believe it was China Lake Naval Air Station had in the days of wars and things like that. I believe China Lake had a large facility which produced a focused beam that was used for bringing something out of the sky down to the bottom.
So you say bring it on, let's do it again on a bigger scale. Are you for it or not?
I'm definitely for it because the point is that it is a good way to do it. And the question then is, can you do it without any environmental problems? I think the environmental problems should not be done, as you just heard on the radio, by comparing microwave dishes to silvered dishes, because the microwave dishes are basically porous to air, whereas the silvered dish is a block.
Yeah, it's a block, and yet it moves, and there's also life beneath. We got a touch of that environmental angle. Dick, thanks very much for calling. Let me get another call here from Worcester, Massachusetts. Dave is on the line. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is a great topic. I guess my point, well, the first thing that came to mind when I heard this is, why not? Why is this technology not being used to its full capacity? It seems like having freedom from fossil fuels and the pollution that's generated would be obviously a...
Sounds like heaven on earth, doesn't it?
Sure. So that brings up a question for me, at least, that are there political and or corporate entities that may be fighting this technology? And that may sound slightly conspiratorial, but...
Well, not necessarily. Everybody's got their business interest in here one way or another. Let us pick it up. Frank Laird, how about it? Resistance to developing solar? Is it out there? And if so, from where?
There's some resistance to developing solar, but I think one of the things that hurts solar more in its resistance has been inconsistent support. If you look at the federal government's policies for solar, the problem they've had over the years, and certainly some groups have talked down solar and argued against supporting it, but the real problem has been that they've been yo-yos. That, you know, a few years it gets hot and sexy and gets support, and then other years it gets cut. It drives the industry crazy. It drives people trying to do research crazy. The most important thing the feds can do is have a steady, consistent policy. I mean, right now in the energy bill we got this last summer, there were some tax credits for solar.
That's right.
But they're set to expire in 3 years. And that's crazy. that you can't do long-term corporate planning for over 3 years, much less research planning in 3 years. So the problem is getting it to be consistent. I know there's also been sort of an ideological component to this. It seems like in the last 15, 20 years, renewables in general, and solar in particular, has been sort of the child of the Democrats and been opposed by the Republicans. But that's not true across the board. The Republicans don't support it. And if you go back to the 1950s and 60s, all the early solar supporters were Republicans. So this potentially has a wide appeal. I think in the 1970s, solar got branded as the sort of Birkenstock crunchy granola technology.
You know, but energy independence sounds pretty good. Yeah,
exactly.
Daniel Kamen, how about it? Does this still need government support, or with natural gas prices in particular so high, are we at or nearing the point where market forces might just kick in and fuel it all on their own?
Well, it needs support, but what it doesn't need is subsidy, and there's really a big difference. I mean, the caller brought up the idea of conspiracy, and you don't have to be sort of looking for evil conspiracies. Any existing industry has a well-established lobby of supporters mm-hmm. who argue for it, which is what the fossil fuel industry has.
Yep.
But the solar industry is sort of the unborn or the newly born baby, and who speaks for the next generation? It's an ongoing question through history. So what solar needs is exactly what Frank said. It needs a consistent policy from the government. It needs funding levels that don't do what they did in the 80s. At one point, the solar energy research budget for the federal government went from $120 million to 60 to 10 and then back up again, which, of course, not only drives people crazy who want to do research, but it tells industry that this is a fickle child of politics industry, not one that's really on its own 2 feet. That's what's different now. And with 20 states having now passed these renewables portfolio standards, and each state doesn't support solar to the same degree,
right. We
have at least a baseline. And the next baseline is to look at what are the opportunities in the business world. And right now, we're finally seeing that big corner turn. So the state of California has actually just put $1.5 billion, so-called green wave money,
mm-hmm.
of my retirement money, in fact. I'm a mm-hmm. state employee from the university. Into that clean and green energy fund, and we have some of the biggest venture capital firms in the state and elsewhere, Venture Point Capital and others, who are now gearing up similar funds. And when that happens, and they see that this industry will not remain as a sort of fickle child of politics, that's when things really take off, and that's where everyone working in the field right now thinks we're right at that point. And so that's why, as Michael Oppenheimer said in the first part of the show, this is a critical decade. We can really make this industry not a half or a 1% player in the economy, but really a major piece. Or we can look back on this decade and say, well, gee, we had a wonderful opportunity with high prices and environmental needs and climate and U.S. soldiers dying overseas, in some cases needlessly, and we could have invested in solar, and we either did or we didn't.
It's incredibly exciting, though, the thought that this could be done. Bruce Osborne was saying earlier that we're looking at GM's woes right now. He described this like the automotive industry in terms of something that would require lots of manufacturing on a big scale. But yet I see here on the photovoltaic side, the U.S. once supplied half of all photovoltaic panels in the world. Now it's down to 8%. Germany and Japan have moved ahead. Are we getting aced out here, Frank Laird? In the meantime, is this going to be an industry based in the U.S. or elsewhere?
Boy, I certainly hope it's going to be an industry based in the U.S. It's happened, as you say, with photovoltaics. We were the dominant manufacturer. Now we're not. With wind turbines, we were the dominant manufacturer. Now we're not. The first wind farm in Colorado was put up with Danish turbines. The Danes are just roaring ahead on this. We're either going to become a world leader in this, or we're going to end up importing all our solar energy technology from someone, just like we import so much of our oil. And that would be a tragic thing, because these are great manufacturing jobs to make these things.
Let's kick it into gear here. Lonnie's calling from Fairfield, Iowa. Hi, Lonnie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for a great program. I wanted to just to say that I've been living here in the Midwest with solar and wind power exclusively. I don't have a connection to the utility grid for about 15 years.
Off the grid for 15 years. You're the man, Lonnie.
Yeah, and I wanted to make a point about the backup, particularly in residential energy. I'm an electrical engineer and kind of a geek, and I have a music studio. I have 3 satellite dishes, high-speed internet, a shop.
Okay.
I have quite a normal life as far as electricity goes.
Yeah.
I have a combination of both wind and solar. And here in the Midwest, often when it's not sunny, it's windy.
Yeah.
So by the combination of the two of those, I have a backup generator. I probably run it 10 hours a year.
So sunny day or stormy day, you're in business. Do you think this could work on a very large scale for the nation, Lonnie?
Well, it could certainly work. I believe that if you look at, if we're talking about solar, well, wind is also solar. Biomass is solar. We have solar hot water, solar thermal technology, solar electricity. If we combine all those together, we could certainly run our economy. The whole economy of nature runs on renewable energy. All the systems that purify our air and water that run the Amazon River, and that uses thousands of times the energy and material flow of man's economy.
Right, that's out there working. Lonnie, we've got the perspective. It sounds like you're out there on the high frontier, and we're glad to hear it, and a vote saying yes, it could work. Daniel Kamen, let me ask you about, Lonnie mentioned both solar and wind, and now there's lots of conversation about where wind farms will go, where they won't go. Is this an either-or question, or are there other renewable energy supplies? I mean, solar is attractive because the sun's up there, it's beaming down, but is it the first target? Is it the best target? Is wind better, or are others better, more economical?
Well, it better not be an either-or, because the biggest lesson we've learned from our energy history is that diversity is our friend, and picking a winner is our enemy,
mm-hmm.
because it gives someone, whether it's an existing industry or a new one, the monopoly situation. And thankfully, solar, as you talked about, is peak in the afternoon, and that's when we need peak power. So solar makes a lot of sense on its own merits. Wind, for example, in California, doesn't blow during the day very much. It blows at night much more heavily,
mm-hmm.
so you would use it to charge up batteries, to pump water in reservoirs, to ship power, to make hydrogen, that sort of thing. But in the Midwest, and the U.S. has the best wind resource in the world for an on-land source.
Okay.
There's a huge tongue of wind power that extends down through the Dakotas, through Minnesota, through the Central Plain states.
Yeah.
Blows wonderfully steadily, and it's wonderfully coincident with the daytime needs. So when you start to say, look, let's have 20% of our energy coming from biofuels and 20% from wind and solar, 20% from natural gas, 20% from nuclear, if you know, depending what your position is, you can really envision a very, very much cleaner and much more secure system. But the bottom line is trying to pick a winner or say, let's wait for one technology to dominate the landscape. Even if that were solar, it wouldn't be a good thing for one industry to be in the driver's seat entirely. You want a portfolio, but you want one as clean and as politically secure as possible.
A lot of horses pulling this chariot. If we can get it, Frank Laird, we've just got a minute here. How optimistic are you? This is the critical decade we're hearing. They're meeting in Montreal as we speak. On the solar front, is it breaking open? Do you see it beginning to really happen on this big scale?
Yes, I do. I'm cautiously optimistic because I've been burned before, but I'm optimistic. A lot of renewable energy technologies now are growing in double digits. People who install photovoltaic panels are going crazy because now there's so much demand they're having trouble getting the panels. Large firms are getting involved in this. The prices are beginning to look good. I'm very optimistic. And Dan, by the way, is dead right that this is going to be a diverse set of technologies. The industry is so huge, there's lots of room for all the technologies. Electricity alone is over $200 billion a year in the United States. I'll take 10% of that.
Me too. It's exciting. And hey, let's get it all in gear and go out and do it. It sounds like it beats a lot of oil and coal. Frank Laird in Denver and Dan Kamen at the University of California, Berkeley. Frank at the University of Denver, thanks to both of you for being with us. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Frank Laird, thank you very much for being with us.
Listeners, thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's been great. Listeners, for a look at these solar dishes we're talking about, visit our website, onpointradio.org, for a link there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.